Tonight we're very pleased to have as our final speaker for 2007, Roxana Dunbar Ortiz. She's an author, historian, social activist. She will be speaking about her newest book, Roots of Resistance, History of Land Tenure in New Mexico, Land Ownership in Northern New Mexico, 1680 to the present. She's going to talk about how indigenous and Mexican farming communities adapted and preserved their fundamental social and economic institutions despite losing control of their land to capitalist entrepreneurs and becoming part of a low-wage labor force. In the final chapter, Roxana applies the lessons of this history to current conflicts in New Mexico over land ownership, use of land, control of minerals, timber, and water.
Thank you for coming out tonight. This book, this version of it, has just come out from University of Oklahoma Press. It has had a long history in itself, 40 years.
Coast to coast.
Its history, the history of the book, turned 40 in August. In August 1967, I was a history graduate student in Latin American history at UCLA. And one day, on the news, on the television news even, and at that time there was no cable, you know, this was on network news, Walter Cronkite or whoever, says there's an armed uprising in northern New Mexico, in the Carson National Park. Men with guns have taken over a courthouse in a small town, Tierra Maria. And I'm thinking, this doesn't happen in the United States. This is pretty volatile period, you know, of the 60s, but this was so different from anything in the civil rights movement or even the American Indian movement had not started occupying land or buildings or whatever. So I took notice. I said, this is the kind of thing that happens in Latin America. And then my next thought was, well, this is Latin America. This was Mexico. Everywhere where I was right then, you know, in Los Angeles, this was Mexico, where we are right now. This was Mexico. And I knew that. We all know that, you know, not everyone, but most of us know that conceptually, but don't make very much of it. And I decided right then that I had just taken my exams to advance to the, my oral exams to advance to the dissertation writing stage, and I had been planning to write on indigenous land, the colonization of Mexico, and to pick a part of Mexico that I would study. And I was maybe thinking of Chiapas or, you know, somewhere in southern Mexico. I immediately decided I'm going, knowing nothing more than, you know, just what I heard on the news. We didn't have internet in those days, so it was hard to find out more, actually. I couldn't think of anyone I knew in New Mexico to find out more. I'm from Oklahoma, and I've driven through on Highway 66 many times back and forth, but I didn't know anyone personally in New Mexico. But I decided that's what I'm going to write my dissertation on. A long story. The next year, I also became very involved in the anti-war movement, the women's movement, and became a wild-eyed radical. And I was already working on the anti-apartheid
that
movement that was just getting started in the United States.
13, 14
went for the summer to London to stay with to work with the African National Congress. Came back a raving revolutionary and burned all my bridges to graduate school, dissertations, anything institutional for the next 5 years or so. And then I came, you know, I actually got invited back to do my dissertation. So by then, they were scrambling to get women PhDs because history had a very bad record. So I said, okay, if I could do this dissertation on New Mexico, because in the meantime, I had learned a lot. I had gone there. I went there in 1969. I learned about it, and I learned that it was a Hispanic. The people there call themselves Hispanos. They started calling themselves Chicanos, the younger people, in the late 1960s. And this developed a kind of breach between, you know, interpretations of history. But that movement, the Alianza, was called itself Indo-Hispano, Indo-Hispano, Indian and Hispanic.
And they negotiated.
The first question I was asked in 1969 by the, I had a real in there because I met Elizabeth Martinez, whom many of you probably know, who was had gone down there from working for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in New York, fundraising for them. She went down there in 1968 and started an Alianza newspaper, El Grupo del Norte, in Espanola, New Mexico. So I went and, you know, learned about it, went up to the villages and
all property.
And it was a huge movement. Lots of national and international attention. And the leader, of course, is Tiarina, like most charismatic leaders, filled with contradictions. But mainly he was in, you know, he's in federal prison.
So the taking of the Leavenworth was completely.
So there was a movement to get him out. This was the same time as the Free Huey movement.
Also, other people. Property law,
we didn't know then, but a few years later we envisioned the COINTELPRO program, you know, counterinsurgency program to do away with any kind of radical activity. But the question I was asked, they said, well, you're part Indian, you're from Oklahoma. You studied Indian land issues. Tell us, what is your opinion why the Indians, the Pueblo Indians, don't support the Alianza movement, the land grant movement?
Is a right.
And I said, I don't know. I don't know a single
for many, many years Pueblo Indian in Mexico and California.
How would I know? It was this sort of thing,
everything was Spanish,
you know, all Indian issues are the same.
And
this kind of homogenization. I really don't know. And so they said, well, why don't you find out for us? So that was when one day I will go back and write this, do this research and write it. And so I turned my dissertation in 1974. And then the UCLA published it, updated as a monograph. I actually went down and lived in New Mexico for 3 years, published the monograph in 1980. So this is a new edition of that monograph, updated and with a new chapter and far more knowledgeable than the first version. So it kind of, you know, the book itself is a kind of journey for my own learning how I think we do go about learning and probably research more about history to really dive into it, you know, more deeply about an issue. It doesn't, shouldn't take 40 years, but I had learned it all in a much shorter time. It's just getting the book back out again is a lot of new crises have come up in New Mexico.
invasion was brutal.
Well, the other thing about this book that I think is makes it really important and relevant, even if you aren't specifically interested in New Mexico or land tenure or Chicanos or northern Mexico that was taken by the United States. If you're not particularly interested in those things, it is also, or fundamentally, it is an application of Marx's capital. Because what I figured out when I was, I studied Marxism, but not Marx, up to 1974. I had read Mandel, and I had read bits and pieces of Marx with exploitations. I had even read the neo-Marxist interpretations like Herbert Marcuse, Jacqueline Hobbes, and the French psychoanalytical linguistic theorist. And historians were getting into psychoanalytical history. I was very interested in that. I had one mentor in UCLA, Donald Myers, who was kind of foremost in doing that. But as I did the research down in the New Mexico archives, I began to get a picture that said, this is very familiar, what's happening here historically.
So they didn't have any time,
at that time, I sat down and read and studied Capital.
The 19th century,
and what he found is, you know, in New Mexico, and you could probably take almost any piece of earth, and sometimes I think that would be a good idea, you know. And do in-depth studies. Because what you find in New Mexico, anyway, what I found, was I compared it to an archaeological dig, where you had these layers of colonialism, and you can go down because the Pueblo Indian culture and at least an atrophied part of their original land base is intact, very strongly intact. You have this archaeology. You have living stories, practices, agricultural practices, communal ones, non-capitalist ones. And I've actually kind of stopped using the term pre-capitalist for communal land tenure of indigenous people because it wasn't ever going to become capitalist.
So you had the wars between
until capitalism intervened through colonialism. So I was really surprised when I read the Marx himself that in all of the interpretations of Marx that I had read, that none of them had begun as Marx did of describing the brutality and the origins of capitalism
through
the living of the Americans.
The Indians sued the United
as
States for
the first stage of the development of enormous profits that could develop not only capitalism,
the Mexican government
going from mercantilism, but the central capitalist state,
all of the land,
the requirement of the state as a as the entity
and through
colonialism. So they Spain was built into a country and its principality, the United Kingdom or Great Britain.
And I think the Mexican period, it's usually
Belgium, Italy, and some of them didn't become real states until the 19th century, but in Germany. So this process of state building, capitalism, we had then in New Mexico the very clear Pueblo land tenure. What it's like to see real communal social relations in action even today.
making
of course, in a distorted form, because
in
a capital colonial setup, but even other native people's land tenure is not as intact as it is among the Pueblos in New Mexico, anywhere in the
history.
Then you have the brutality of early colonialism, early Spanish colonialism coming in. And I begin to see the details of this. These are people who had, it's an arid area, had irrigation farms before the Europeans came to have it for thousands of years. Where they had lived before Mesa Verde, they had built huge city-states and had gigantic irrigation systems, waterproofs, leak-proof
people there.
Those have all been excavated, but they transferred to the Rio Grande Valley and built smaller units. They're still city-states, but small, 98 city-states along the Rio Grande, Northern Rio Grande, and the tributaries up into Southern Colorado. Under the Spanish, New Mexico was what is today Arizona, Utah, Colorado, and New Mexico, part of Texas. That was New Mexico and down into what's Chihuahua and Sonora today. So it was a much larger area than the U.S. cut it under their rectangular states as they did in the West. So the Hopis were included in this network of farming city-states. They lived in dwellings that were multi-story dwellings around. So you can really look at the system in detail, how it worked, how they resisted despite the labor-intensive work of irrigation farming, how they resisted either class formation or
was taking that trade.
They didn't take Mark, the trade that they took, I think, so borrowing the erroneous idea of Oriental despotism, Egypt, enslavement to build pyramids and so forth. And to some extent, that happened in central Mexico. But clearly, the Pueblos are a case of people in an arid area developing a civilization who maintained democracy. And of full participation of everyone, and prominence of women. Of course, Ingalls did studies of the role of women. The downfall of women at some point. You see the very strong role of women in controlling the distribution of food, in particular, and equally being farmers. So the Spanish come in, they bring not only slavery, they bring African slaves, they call them Moors at that time, North African slaves, and Indian slaves, Indians they had enslaved in Mexico, that they called Tlaxcans, and came to be called Jenisos, Hispanized Indians they brought in. So there were about 100 Spanish settlers, and they didn't even make lists of these people. It's funny because they made lists, their musters, of every single cow and horse and sheep. But they didn't make a list of even the numbers of slaves they had with them. But we do know within about 10 years after they had set up Santa Fe as their capital, there was a kind of bursting at the seams barrio or slum of workers from this class. So they couldn't have reproduced themselves so quickly. So probably there were about 5,000 to 6,000 slaves.
Accept that as a
so they brought in cattle. They brought in horses. These are devastating the irrigation ditches. Made out of dirt. They were a parasite the colonists because they had no food. So really the first several years they simply went and took food. And this was devastating to the Pueblos because they had, they dried their corn, they dried their beets to get through the winter, pretty long, cold winter, very high altitude. It really gets into the, you know, into the Rocky Mountains. And they didn't have a great deal of surplus. Plus, they the Christian missionaries went in, the Franciscans, and started trying to convert people. So you had the beginnings of resistance, which you always do. That's another pattern. Colonialism, you had the resistance, and then in 1680, 8 years after the conquest, Pueblos and Hopis and Navajos and Apaches, all of the Indians, plus these enslaved people, the servants, in such things, united, and later, of course, it was uncovered they had been planning for generations for this, and they successfully drove the Spanish out completely in this unified uprising in 1680. And they held them at bay, kept them out for 12 years. They destroyed every single vestige of Spanish culture. They slaughtered any of the animals. They cut down any kinds of plants and trees that had been brought from Spain, and fruit trees. They melted down the crosses. And of course, they destroyed the churches and simply went to started rebuilding their culture after 80 years of deep colonialism. So then, by that time, it was the second stage of colonialism.
They had
the British had come on the scene, the French had come on the scene, Spanish had been defeated in 1588, and were in a decline, so they were really trying to hang on to their empire. And New Mexico was the northernmost, New Mexico being Colorado, the northernmost extent of their empire. Missouri, Florida, you know, they were, well, most of North America was Spanish territory. And the French had come in, English were a few little colonies in the, on the eastern seaboard. And the Russians, a few little colonies on the first European international border was Russia.
It's gotten worse and worse in the 21st century.
So that the others were like coming. So the Spanish decided they wanted to recolonize New Mexico for the purpose of maintaining the frontier.
The Treaty of Guadalupe, another thing.
So they came in and
they
sort of tried to negotiate their way back, and they were rebuffed, so they came in with another large conquest, a brutal conquest, burning villages. They reduced, they had already reduced the number of Pueblos, 98 city-states, to 23 in that first 9 years. So they further reduced, they destroyed 4 more Pueblos. And it was worse than that, the way the Pueblos worked, if they had any kind of dissension, lost the sense of collectivity or faction, one or the other would simply go build another village, rather than they did everything by consensus. So they would just build another autonomous village, and then the villages would get along fine for whatever purposes they had to, but if they couldn't, you know, some kind of factionalism formed. Well, they could no longer expand like that. The other thing they did traditionally was there was a bubonic plague existed before the Europeans came in New Mexico and other parts of the hemisphere. So when they had any kind of infectious disease like that spread, they would simply they burn down their whole city state. Burn it down and go build another one.
Of water for
that's how I mean they took it. Everything was for
especially
the betterment of the community.
They
had no investment in that structure.
They don't call there is a potential of Indian water rights.
People. They from some I mean, it's very practical if you think of it. And they go build another city.
And that was
they might be refugees for a while, living you know, another 4 months while they built their new city state. They could no longer do that. So diseases were spread, you know, because they were closed in. They could no longer use the extreme measures needed to not allow that to happen. Nor did they ever, you know, traditionally they didn't isolate people.
Government
people who were sick.
Like
the first sign of it is just
one size fits all.
They,
well, in the case of the water rights,
they took care of it. So they had already been crippled by 80 years and reduced in numbers and number of cities by war and disease and enslavement. But the Spanish came in and they did realize that they better not mess around with Pueblo land or their religion or try to Christianize them. So the 18th century of Spanish colonialism up to 1821 when Mexico became independent was a kind of static relationship. But one thing they did was they started making these land grants to these. They were very afraid of this collection of servants
in
Santa Fe, which had burgeoned to about 15,000 people. And they wanted to break them up because they realized that that was quite a force when joined with the Pueblos and they had plenty of complaints of their living conditions and treatment. So they did these new land grants.
To be
and placed settlements on the frontier. And these people are called Janiceros. That's the same terminology as mestizo in the rest of Latin America, but in Mexico uniquely in the Spanish Empire is called Janiceros. And that word comes from Janissary, the Turkish word for converts. You know, for people conquered and converted. So they're sort of, the best description is tribalized.
The best definition of Janiceros is
it's pretty,
Indians.
Pretty interesting. They have
their mixture of
the kind of role, I would say, in other parts, say the British Empire or the United States. Empire of poor whites, poor rural whites. So it's a little, it gives you a kind of perspective on other situations, like other colonial situations, like the Pianor and Algeria, many of the whites in South Africa, the Boers in South Africa, and others, where they have legitimate complaints, but nevertheless, they are a part of the colonial project that took the indigenous land. So that is the, to answer that question I was asked the first time I went here, why don't the Indians support the land grant struggle? Well, that's my answer, you know, that these are unresolved situations of colonialism all over the world. And so I think Marxism makes this so much, Marx's analysis of the situation makes it so much clearer than the usual kind of ethnic studies approach. No one had ever taken a class approach to the study of ethnicity in Mexico or in most of the situations. And you can't end up with just a well, they should all get together because they're on the same side, you know. And the real enemy in New Mexico are the wealthy industrialists and developers, and they're almost all angled. But there is an elite class among the Hispanics who do not call themselves Mexicans, hated the independence movement, were against it, wanted to stay Spanish. And in New Mexico, they then, once Mexico became independent in 1821, they began collaborating immediately with these United States merchants, one of whom you'll recognize his name is Kit Carson. And these began to be called the American Party of Taos. Taos was the big market center. And the trade route under the Spanish was the Taos market fair, the goods traveled, whatever was produced in New Mexico, which was mostly sheep, and sheep products, wool, and some manufactured things in the first century. Cotton was native to New Mexico, so a lot of cotton clothing and mantas, they call them shirts. They produced for the whole Spanish Empire. They traveled through down to Chihuahua, that market, and then on down to Veracruz to the ships that then went, you know, for the trade around the world. That continued under Mexico for a little while. The merchants out of St. Louis, which was the dropping off point of the United States at that time, and you know, 1821, that was the
frontier. But the Ministro class kept growing because they kept
St. Louis was then they really first conquered New Mexico
on the frontier, but not let the Spanish expand
the merchants into the trade. And they were able to change the trade route from Taos to St. Louis. And actually kill, you know, that trade connection with the South.
Simply take people out.
And so they then collaborated for the U.S. military to come in as well.
They would take captives.
And this group, even though they collaborate with the Americans at that time and have always, they've always sought to be dealt with as equals, they've been treated, you know, because of the racism in the United States as lower species, this elite. So, but they have always had this kind of it. Now, I'm talking about, like, about 100 families, you know, not a huge number of people. But they, in the last, you know, since the Alianza movement, which was really started by poor farmers, the elite kind of latched on to it. And but when the movement itself died out, and when the Chiconismo began disintegrating, you know, as a powerful movement, which it was in the 60s and 70s, they kind of moved in and hijacked the idea of the land grants.
Unique and
these communal land grants were very different from the impresario land grants, but it's private land grants to the very wealthy Spanish families. So that's the situation now where that class of people really have gained cultural hegemony in New Mexico. And Bill Richardson was really, they really brought him in. I mean, it gives you a different view on people like Bill Richardson. But local politics is almost entirely in control of this group of people, the police, the counties. So it brings a direct conflict with the Pueblo Indians, but also the poor Hispanics.
They recreate it, but it's very different.
And all the time, you know, there's the Anglo class, and of course the military industrial complex that came in after World War II to New Mexico, or actually during World War II with the Manhattan Project and Los Alamos being. They simply appropriated that land from one of the Pueblos, moved the people out to the most pristine, beautiful spot in all of New Mexico, these hot springs that were sacred, you know, to the Pueblos that they're not allowed to get near now. So, has anyone been to Los Alamos? I think it's the spookiest place I've ever my cell phone wouldn't even work there. I got so paranoid. I didn't want to spend the night there. They had, were putting me up, you know, a bookstore there to speak. And I wanted to stay the next day. Richard Rhodes was coming in to speak on his new book, you know, on the nuclear third in this trilogy. And I couldn't bring myself to stay. You know, I just, I had to get out of there. It was really, really oppressive. But, you know, I thought if I were an enemy of the United States, this is the first place I would get to. But it dominates. You know, the federal government really dominates. Now, as for the land claims of the Pueblo Indians, a good deal of their land claims are in these Hispanic land grants. But those land grants aren't in the hands of the Hispanics. That's what the whole land grant movement was about. When the United States came in, it set up a court of private land claims. And one of the first decisions that court made was that all the communal land, the commons, you know, the Spanish were still going by the old Roman law in Mexico too. It's sort of like the ejido in Mexico in the 20th century of giving not only the, you know, the town, the living space, and the plots of land, could be owned by families privately, but couldn't be sold. But they, you know, they could be controlled privately.
You know, from a land grant,
they were indivisible. They couldn't be sold. But then they all had use of the commons too, and that's how they survived. Because they get their wood, their water, they get hunt, and these were, you know, tens of thousands of acres. Well, what the United States did was deny the commons, just as in Europe, you know, the commons were denied, and this choked the small farmers. They couldn't survive, just only their own vegetable plots, you know, without. They had to buy their wood or fuel. They had to dig water wells, which is expensive and not very good for the earth, or to be moved near the water. There was no land there. They couldn't support a growing population, so they, you know, they became a proletariat. So this is the other part of the book, the proletarianization process of driving people off the land.
Well, in the 70s and 80s,
I wanted to read just
that movie,
this little bit that all of you will
recognize. The Motor
Truck.
Easy Rider. You know, where they have dinner with the family there, and they talk a little bit, and, you know, the hippies start.
So long as the laborer can accumulate for himself, and this he can do so long as he remains possessor of his own production, capital accumulation and the capitalist mode of production are impossible. The process, therefore, that clears the way for the capitalist system can be done as a process which takes away from the laborer the possession of his means of production. The expropriation of the agricultural producer of the peasant from the soil is the basis of the whole process.
They all put on jackets. They get down there. We're sober belts. Anyway, they completely taken over Santa Fe and Taos and misuse the water, and of course then they have to have golf courses. courses and what they have to have, you know, other. So it's really a problem. And so many people can only make money, they're the Pueblos and the Henestros villagers, off their arts and crafts. And they're dependent then on these rich people. And some of the Henestro villages, like Chimayo, are just, you know, there are these resorts and bed and breakfasts and, you know, for spas, and there are hot springs down there too, so the Hema Springs. And so it's you know, people have loved New Mexico too much. You know, people ask me down there, why don't you come back and live here? I said, I don't want to be associated with I'd be called, you know, an Anglo exploiter, you know, if I come here. I said, no, no, there are exceptions, but it is, it's really a huge problem in New Mexico, and especially in the most traditional areas. And it's eroding, you know, it's another phase of erosion. So also, you know, the land grant struggle, like I said, it's kind of gotten hijacked by this kind of ruling, this ruling elite of Hispanos who want to bring in more development and, you know, more for New Mexico to be more in the mainstream of the United States.
Yeah, could you explain that a little bit more? Because, you know, my acquaintance with the Alianza movement was that it was, you know, a pretty radical movement, takeovers of buildings and so forth, takeover of land, occupations. And what happened to where that movement was co-opted by the elites? You know, how did that happen? Because I know it was some very militant people, a lot of militant Chicanos that were involved with that, and just what happened there?
Well, you know, this has largely happened since I, you know, published the book first in 1980. So I spent the last couple of years investigating just that question, what has happened? Because a lot of clashes have developed, culture clashes, that in the first version of my book, and still in this one, I show, you know, the Pueblos and the Janisteros coming closer and closer together. The Pueblos made a film that was broadcast nationwide on PBS in 1992, the 500-year anniversary of Columbus, the Quincentenary. It's kind of an anti-Quincentenary movie called Before Columbus. And in it, they included the Janisteros villages as indigenous villages. And they had, you know, spokespeople. That was just so encouraging. It was what my book was all about, is these people have an interest in common. And these are tribalized Indians who did get land. It's not really theft of land from, you know, from the Pueblos. And that's different from the private land grants. Well, since 1992 to the present, and that's only 15 years, some drastic things have happened. And I do think, you know, Bill Richardson plays a part in this. This elite class, first of all, had a reaction against the coming out, you might say, of the Pueblos and openly celebrating in 1980 the Pueblo Revolt. It was the first time that, you know, publicly celebrated it. They have always had this upper class Hispanic elite. They have always had their parades on the anniversary of Oñate, de Vargas, the second conqueror who came in 1692, the reconquest. And they call it the reentrada, you know, the re-entrance. And say it was peaceful and everything, and they reenact it in Santa Fe and put on the costumes and all. And the Pueblos kind of ignore this. You know, it's like, okay, this little, you know, little parade that no one pays much attention to. But in 1992, it was the 400-year anniversary, 400 years anniversary of, 300-year anniversary of De Vargas coming in, you know, because that was in 1692. So it was the 300 years. So the celebration that year, I think it was a backlash to the huge indigenous movement that built up in the anti-Kim centenary. Do not celebrate Columbus. You know, this was a huge thing that gave birth to an enormous international indigenous movement that made real changes. I mean, Pedro Morales was a part of this, as a very young man, you know, opposing the Kim centenary, celebrating it. And Spain was in the Vatican, were insistent on making huge celebrations of this, bringing civilization to the Americas. They literally put it that way and put huge amounts of money into it. And of course, the Reagan administration in the 80s put lots of money into the Kim centenary. And so I think that even though the Pueblos had never before protested the De Vargas celebration, they did that year because they had gotten activated. And I think this was seen as a kind of breakdown of the status quo, you know, that we do our thing, you do your thing, and we won't argue with each other. And by that time, it was pretty clear, you know, that the Chicano, the younger generation, had grown up with the consciousness of the Chicano movement, which was very strongly aligned with the American Indian movement. And the American Indian movement itself was pretty crushed, you know, by COINTELPRO and really smashed. I mean, it still existed in name, but it didn't have a coherence. So there was a kind of vacuum there. And I think they then just ran with it and said, now we're going to have Hispano pride, and we're going to teach this in the schools. And so by 1998, which was then the anniversary of Oñate, the first conqueror, who was so bad, such a genocidal criminal, that he was arrested and carried in chains back to Spain at the time for his brutality. It's not that, you know, the Indians just say he was brutal. He was too brutal even for the Spanish Empire. And, you know, the priest had complained he's causing trouble because he's just murdering, he's dismembering, he does it with his own hands, he's bloodthirsty, he's corrupt. They decided to celebrate this man. They had never celebrated before. So they got through by that time, you know, all through the 90s, Phil Richardson played a big role in putting a lot of funds into this class of people, because this was his constituency. He's not from New Mexico. He's from a very wealthy North American businessman who married into a very wealthy Mexican family. And he grew up mainly in Mexico City and Dallas, I think, or, you know, some city in the north. So he was an import, and that usually doesn't work very well in New Mexico. So this was, I think, a part of it was his building up this constituency to then support him politically. And that ties into it. But they started commissioning all these statues of Oñate. And the statues got bigger and bigger until last year, the largest equestrian statue in the world was placed in the El Paso airport. Because that's where Oñate came in. You know, that's called El Paso the Pass, where they came into how they conquered Mexico. So the Pueblos are incensed, you know, at this celebration. They could take De Vargas, okay, we won't say anything, you know, too bad about De Vargas. You guys can have him. Well, pretty, actually pretty patient people. But on Mount Day, that's too much. And if you look at the cover of my book, it's a Pueblo Indian painting of the Oñate's massacre of the people at Acoma Pueblo up on Sky City. It's just killed probably 3,500 people, almost wiped them out, captured 300, and there were no women and children left. The men and boys that they captured, the sentence was to cut off the right foot of each of them as punishment. And so that depicts the dismemberment of. So it was a very, very cruel. So especially Acoma Pueblo, which took it's the lowest, most southern, took the brunt of the Oñate conquest. So I think it's a combination of those factors that have and maybe, it's healthy in some ways because the Pueblos have kind of kept to themselves and just hunkered down and tried to survive. And now they're coming out and saying things that the Hispanos have never heard them say, because they didn't say them publicly before. But there's quite a strong clash now. And I think even more, my book is important because it does make that class analysis. It's not just an ethnic question, it's also a class issue, that is predominant and important.
To what extent do you think the explosion of Indian gambling casinos is benefiting the Native American people?
Well, it depends on where. In New Mexico, it's very benefit. It's not just benefiting the Indians, but the whole economy. They generally have, as part of this New Mexico being so sexy. But generally, the casinos are resort casinos, and they already had, quite a lot of gambling in New Mexico that wasn't Indian related. They had dog races, for instance, which doesn't exist in many places, and all horse racing and stuff that were legal. It has really, really benefited. Not all the Pueblos have casinos. It's not very lucrative, unless you're on the highway or near the highway. Acoma does have on I-40, Acoma and Laguna have casinos. It has greatly improved. They put it back into developing transportation system, jobs, it provides jobs. It's mixed back east. The really, really big ones are, I don't know as much about, and I know there are very small groups of Indians who have only recently gotten acknowledgement as Indian tribes. In California, it varies. It varies how they make the pacts with the states. And California, it's done well for those who have them, and they provide part of their profits to the non-gaming tribes, but it creates quite a differential, between the standard of living between the gaming and non-gaming tribes. So it's a mixed bag. I feel like, if you're going to do economic development and you think of capitalism and the environment and everything, really gambling is one of the least harmful capitalist enterprises around. It just pollutes the water, like Silicon Valley, and all the chemicals. I don't feel very. I mean, would it be better to have a meat packing plant, or a chemical plant, or a nuclear never see it again, Wendy. So I think it's hard for people to get used to Indians being prosperous, that they sort of don't understand that the real issue is Indian sovereignty and not poverty, and that, you know, they're colonized and they want to get out of that and be able to restore their the integrity of their cultures. I work with a group of young Navajos who are trying to develop. They're very inspired by Bolivia and have decided to try to develop an alternative to capitalism and are developing a project of indigenous socialism. You know, how to, Navajo Nation is the biggest in territory and population. It's almost 1 million people now. And, you know, a huge, rich territory. So that would be really significant, you know, if they develop. So far they don't have, they haven't gone for gaming. And they want to go in a different direction, so they may provide a new model, not just for other Indians, but other communities that are performing local socialism.
Have they used any of their profits to any significant extent in developing programs, social service programs?
That's mainly what they do with it.
Yeah.
They couldn't, the way Indians operate, they couldn't get by without doing that. They would be in trouble. factions, and factions have developed, like the Mohawk. The Mohawks up on the Canadian-New York border are very divided about gaming. There's a traditional group who want nothing to do with gaming. And that goes back even to the liquor and cigarette sales, you know, that proceeded because of the tax-free status. Other people, like myself, my main fear of gambling or even the, you know, tax-free goods is if that's, you know, the main manifestation of sovereignty, of governmental sovereignty, that it doesn't win that many friends in the general population. That it's, you know, it's seen as more pecuniary, you know, and less productive. And so I think, you know, a lot of the traditionals feel that it's not the best way to go. So there are divisions in the Native population, you know, about this, and arguments within families. You know, it's an interesting discussion because I think it has really led to this, well, let's look at an alternative and this idea of indigenous socialism and how that might work. So there's some really a lot of interesting thinking going on. But one thing it's produced, you know, is it's been going on for about 20 years now, the gaming, and there's the education in particular, educating, the level of education and that has developed is just, it's making all kinds of changes. And these young people who are thinking of indigenous socialism are kind of children of gaming-funded education. An interesting contradiction. Well, I better let you all go. I can talk to you all night. I really thank you for coming. And you can find my book on the web. You know, go to my website, redirtsite.com, redirtsite.com. And it will lead you how to order it from University of Oklahoma Press. Or get it, or have your bookstore order it, and then it gets in the bookstore. Don't order it from your bookstore.